Considering Biblical Sexual Ethics in the Context of Modern Culture, Part 2. The second talk in a series titled Ethics of Sex in the Bible was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 7, 2014, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 1, Considering Biblical Sexual Ethics in the Context of Modern Culture, accompanies this talk.
Okay, so just housekeeping here. Anyone who's streaming, if you need a handout, the handout is the same as the handout for last week. I'm just going to continue on in those notes. You can get those if you don't already have those. There should be a link on the live stream page to the handout, or you can go to the Gutenberg webpage and there you can find the PDF to download on there. And if you have questions that you want to somehow draw our attention to during the streaming, there's a comment section on your page. In fact, if you scroll down the comments that are already there, 5 or 6 or 7 comments down, you should have some instructions about how to post a comment and bring your question to our attention. I can't promise that we'll see it and get to it in a really timely manner, but we'll do the best we can. That's the best we can do at this point. All of you here have a handout, okay? So after some introductory comments last week, we got into the essence of this part of the class, and that is to compare the attitudes and values and perspective of the Bible to that of modern culture, with and focusing with respect to sexuality in particular. And we only got to the first one last week in that comparison, and that was basically, to in a nutshell, modern culture is quite content with the perspective that when it comes to sexuality, my physiology, my body chemistry, the elements of my sexuality are just given. They're just thrown there. They don't have a reason. They don't have a purpose. They don't have a design. They're just what they are. And it's up to me as a human being, it's up to us as human beings to decide what we're going to do with our sexuality. And we can basically do with our sexuality whatever we decide we want to do with our sexuality. Because there is no right or wrong, there is no objective design and purpose that we're answerable to in any way. The biblical view, on the other hand, sees nature, sees creation as fundamentally teleological in its nature. It's telic in its nature. It has design, function, purpose, and there's an objective truth about that design and the purposes that God had in mind for our sexuality. There's something objectively real about that. And as I will argue probably a number of times here, to understand the biblical sexual ethic, you have to understand that what's right and what's good with respect to human sexuality is to act, behave, desire, think in a way that is in conformity to and compatible with God's purposes, that objective reality about God's purposes for sexuality. But that's a fundamental difference between the biblical worldview and the modern worldview. And so in deciding what we're going to do with biblical sexual ethics, one of the questions we have to ask is, who's got that right? Modern culture or the Bible? I think the Bible does, but if you accept the modern culture's perspective on reality, then an ethic that says anything goes makes all the sense in the world. Okay, that brings us then to the second point of comparison between modern culture and the biblical view, and that's point B on the outline, on page 5, I think, of your handout. Immoral judgment with regard to sexual behavior, as with regard to any and all behavior, must be made on the basis of a rational moral judgment, grounded in the biblical worldview, and not on the basis of what feels right or feels natural or feels acceptable. This has increasingly become a problem in Western civilization and in American culture as we've progressed out of the 20th century into the 21st century. Increasingly, we are leaving behind the notion that I should think my way to the truth, I should reason my way to the truth. And it's increasingly become, well, what I should believe to be true is what feels true to me, right? What feels natural, what feels acceptable, what feels plausible to me. That's going to be a big difference, because I'm going to suggest that what we feel about our beliefs and our values and so on, our feelings with respect to them or our feelings toward them, are a product of our culture. It feels natural and it feels plausible if it's familiar to me. It's really a question of familiarity. And it becomes familiar to me the more I live with it, see it around me, practice it, think in terms of those values. The more comfortable I make myself with a certain perspective, the more that perspective feels true to me and seems true to me. Well, obviously, if I can become familiar with a perspective that's false, that false perspective, although it is false, is nonetheless going to feel true and right and plausible. And therefore, how I feel about it is not a reliable guide to what is actually objectively true. It's just not a reliable guide. So it's very important that I have the ability and I make the commitment and I discipline myself to always ask myself the question, regardless of how it feels to me, what do I think about this? What would sound reasoning lead me to conclude is the truth on this matter or the truth on this subject? Now, as I said in my introductory comments last week, part of the perspective of a biblical worldview and somebody who wants to follow Jesus and believes the Bible, a big input into what I know to be true is going to be, what does the Bible teach me is true? And I'm going to use my head to determine that. I'm going to think about it. I'm going to think intelligently about the text, try to recreate, grasp, lay hold of the understanding of the teaching of the Bible, let that be my guide, and conform my thinking to what it has taught me. Even if that what it teaches me seems to fly in the face of everything that just seems right and good and natural to me. So again, that's part of what it means, I think, to be a follower of Jesus and certainly a Bible-believing Christian, is to make that commitment to the authority, the value, the worth of the Bible's teaching, so much so that I'm going to allow it to stand judgment over what seems right and natural and good to me. And most people in modern culture are not even going to go anywhere near there, obviously. The best guide to truth for them is just, well, you know, how do I react? How do I respond? How does it feel to me? Does it feel right or does it not feel right to me? You know, way back in the 60s, there was, I guess it would have been I don't know what genre of music it was, but a popular song played on the radio. The lyrics were all about an adulterous relationship. And how can anything that feels so right be wrong, fundamentally? Well, good question. I mean, from the standpoint of the modern world, what else is there except how it feels to me? If it feels good, if it feels beautiful, if it feels wonderful, if it feels fulfilling, if it feels rewarding, what more is there to think about? What more is there to say? Well, from a biblical perspective, there's the question of how does it conform or does it conform to God's design, God's purposes, the objective truth about sexuality as God created it? I have to also ask that question. And it may very well be that my conclusions with regard to that trump how I feel. Okay. That very point is what Paul was getting at in chapter 12 of Romans, verse 2, I think it is, when he says, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind." Now, he's not talking about sexuality there. He's talking about our perspective on significance and importance as people more generally. But the principle that he's applying there is a universal principle. The concept of the world for Paul, as it is throughout the Bible, the concept of the world is the concept of a world culture. That is, I live, I breathe, I'm surrounded by a culture that has been created by rebellious, evil human beings who have other priorities other than to honor, respect, and obey and serve God. That's not their priority. And the cultures they've built are imbued with values that are contrary to the values that you would find in a culture that was wanting to honor and serve and obey God. So, but those cultures that we're immersed in shape us. They mold us. They shape our thinking. They shape our attitudes. They shape our values. They create us. We are products of our culture. And Paul is saying, but as a follower of Jesus, you have to resist that. You can't let that happen. Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. And he's specifically talking there about your mental outlook on things, how you think about what you believe, what you value. Those things must not be just adopted and absorbed from the culture that wants to create you. You need to resist that. With your mind, mold your mind around what's true, not around what the culture says is objective reality. So let me just give you a couple more examples to illustrate what I'm talking about. How often do you see a movie where you take something that from a biblical perspective is utterly immoral, an adulterous relationship in a movie, but the movie is this well-crafted movie makes the adulteress and the adulterer completely sympathetic characters, beautiful people. And the relationship, the love between the adulterer and the adulteress is a beautiful love relationship. The movie itself has you cheering for them. You want them to enjoy the ecstasy of this wonderful love that they have for each other. Never mind the abandoned kids, the wife who's been dealt with treacherously by the adulterous husband. Never mind all that. This is so beautiful. This feels so beautiful that surely it has to be good. Surely it has to be right. I mean, that it's messing with us. It's messing with our minds because it's making what is literally morally obscene seem good and right and beautiful. Now, the fact that they have done that, I mean, that's not necessarily problematic unless we don't critique it, unless we don't think, unless we don't stop to say, but what is reality? But what is truth? What is objectively real here? We can then do that and recognize that this is fantasy that we're being shown here on the screen. This isn't reality. The reality is adultery is dangerous, damaging, destructive, obscene, and evil. But to the extent that modern culture doesn't want to think, doesn't want to stop to assess things as to their objective truth, and just wants to feel with what is there to feel, we just get molded and shaped and conformed to the values of the culture around us. Okay? Questions or comments about that? Yes, sir.
Building off of your last point, process it. A lot of times, like people that I completely agree, I think adultery is this massively destructive and horrible and really difficult thing, but I guess from the perspective of art, I mean, are we saying that all art has to be morally edifying? Or, like, we have to present, I don't know, I guess it just seems to me more complex than simply saying that adultery is bad, marriage is good when there are plenty of bad marriages, and adultery may always be bad in itself, but there may be some redemptive aspect to come out of it.
I wasn't intending to make a point about art and whether that movie should exist or how that movie should work. I'm not sure I have any real insight into what art should do in that respect. I should at least know, however, I mean, it's up to me to know when art is lying to me. Should art ever lie to me? I think I'd have a problem of conscience if I'm an artist and I devote my life to lying to people. I'd have a problem with that, but I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a time and place for fantasy in art. That's not really my point. My point is when I finally make a moral judgment about something like adultery, I need to base that on what's objectively true and what my mind tells me is objectively true, not how I'm made to feel. That's really my only point at this point.
That's just interesting. I do watch a lot of movies, and I think from my perspective, I'm sure it's changing over time, but I feel like there's still this, that people still show like adultery as something that has a lot of bad ramifications. So I don't feel like it's glorified. Maybe I'm watching the wrong movies, but I was thinking of one, actually my face is getting red because I'm going to say an R-rated movie, but but I can't remember the name, but it's with like Ralph Fiennes and also Julianne Moore. But she has an affair, and just as they have this affair, like this bomb drops, I think it's in the 40s, but they show, the whole movie shows like a series of like things that are really bad that happen because of it. Because like jealousy, all kinds of bad things. And like they never really have this great thing happen because of this adultery. So in, from what I've seen, I'm sure there's other movies that I, because maybe don't see, but that I still see there's like remnants of holding on to the bad part of adultery, in, even in a movie today. But I can see how you have to still sift through it all and like to make sure, actually analyze it.
Sure.
And then I also think, too, there's still this feeling, like you said, that the culture feels can make you, like, you know, feel that something is right when it's wrong. But I still feel like there's something that we've covered up so much that I think at like a basic level, when you do something wrong, that you do feel something that's bad. Or at least I do. Maybe that's because I'm a Christian. But I don't know if you know what I'm saying.
Not quite.
Well, you said before that we're kind of, it's kind of like the frog in the boiling pot of water, that we're getting so, if we're exposed to this culture so much that we actually base things on like feelings, and then we don't, you know, feel so bad anymore about like something that's wrong. But I would say that unless we're lying to ourselves, that we still feel that, you know, badness. And so maybe like some people are just, you know, fine with lying to themselves, or they are. Like maybe it's because I'm a Christian or not. I'm not sure. But I still feel like there's this underlying like sadness or like dissatisfaction, you know, that happens.
Yeah. Well, I would hope so, and I would expect so. Paul in one of his letters talks about people having a seared conscience. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible for people to so suppress any kind of positive response to truth that it's no longer really affecting them. So there is always that as a possibility. But yeah, I would hope that more people would still have a conscience of some kind. See, I want to be careful because one of the books we read here at Gutenberg that has been very powerful to me and very influential on my thinking is a book called Personal Knowledge by Michael Polanyi. It's a difficult book to read, but it's a very, very important book, I think. It really helped me understand the relationship between faith and reason in an important kind of way. And one of the things that he points out is how much of our rationality, because that's what I'm advocating, is let's be rational about this. But much of our rationality is what he calls tacit. It comes in hunches and intuitions, and it doesn't, we don't get there by a Euclidean argument. We just see, and we see it for what it is. I'm not discounting that at all. Sometimes oftentimes we use feel, the word feel, when we mean think. Well, I feel like that's not true. And what we mean is, I don't think that's true. My intuition tells me that's not true. Well, that's okay. That's my rationality, hopefully. Hopefully that's my rationality telling me that that's not likely to be true. That's good. That's what we should do. And oftentimes our moral, our conscience is that. It's, we may feel attracted to something evil over here, but my rationality doing moral reasoning over here says, but I don't think that's right. I don't think that's good. And the point is we should listen to that and not make our moral judgment, not base our moral judgment on this other thing. This thing that is purely an emotional, psychological response that has been molded and shaped and given to me by my culture. That's really my only point. Okay, should we go on? Third point, C. My physical sexual nature is not an essential element of what I am as a human being. It is not an essential facet of what I am as a creature created in the image of God. In the biblical worldview, I think, I transcend my body. My physical body in general is not an essential element to what makes me, me. In fact, I will eventually have another wholly new physical body, or what Paul calls in 1 Corinthians 15, made of a different distinctive kind of flesh. So I don't require being in this present material physical body in order to be me. When it comes to my sexuality, it is helpful to think of myself as a person, a being created in the image of God, given an animal-like body through which to act and express myself. The animal-like body through which I do and must express myself is a less noble, less eternal, and less beautiful facet of who I am. Now, I surprise myself at saying this because I have spent years combating Platonism and have recognized how much Platonism has just wreaked havoc in Christianity from the very beginning, from the get-go. I'm still rejecting Platonism. I think Platonism is wrong. But I've taken a step back from where I was back in the 1960s. In the middle of the 20th century, I mean, it came along with the counterculture in the 1960s, the hippies and everything. There was a big book that came out, bestseller, called The Joy of Sex about that time. And there were lots of underground magazines that got put out on the street by the street people. And basically, all of them had the same thrust, and that was, sex is not dirty. My physical, biological being is not disgusting. It's not inferior. It's nothing to be ashamed of. I should embrace my physicality. I should, and with that is my sexuality. I should embrace my sexuality. I should see it as the good and truly beautiful thing that it is, and not think of it as something disgusting and dirty and depraved and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I was all about that. Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing in the Bible that would encourage us to see my physicality and sexuality as dirty and disgusting and so on. In fact, it's created by God, it's wonderful, it's good, and that's all there is to it. So something we should celebrate, absolutely. Well, I have to take a step back. I come to realize now that was a lie, actually. That wasn't really accurate. That wasn't really true. I mean, the alternative is not true. The alternative that sexuality is inherently evil, inherently disgusting, inherently dirty, and so on, that's not the only alternative. The alternative is what God really had in mind when he created me was to create a person. And in this present physical age, material age, he created a person with a body, this body, the body that we have and we inhabit now. But the day is going to come when God is going to create and give us a new body. And read 1 Corinthians 15. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15. He says there's different kinds of flesh, and there's different kinds of glory. The glory of the stars is one thing, the glory of the sun is another, the glory of this is one, the glory of that is another. And there's different kind of flesh. There's this kind of flesh and this kind of flesh. And I think the way he's using flesh there is there's different ways of being a concrete creature. There's different ways of being a tangible creature. We are tangible creatures right now because we are connected to and associated with and operate in this body, this mortal body, this corruptible body, this body that is subject to decay. But that's not what God ultimately and finally had in mind for me. What he ultimately and finally had in mind for me was to live in what he goes on to call a heavenly body, or alternatively a spiritual body, in contrast to the natural body that I have now, or the earthly body that I have now. So he contrasts the earthly natural body and the heavenly spiritual body that I will be raised up to when after I die and God raises me from the dead. Well, the reason that's significant is this isn't me then. This is corruptible. This is decaying. This is falling apart. This is going away. This was never intended to be eternal. It was never intended to be permanent. It was never intended to be essentially me. It's nothing to hang on to and celebrate. It's something rather, from a biblical perspective, to sanctify now, to employ it and use it and think of it and take an attitude toward it that makes it holy by what I do with it. But if I don't have the right attitude and perspective toward this body right now, then it's not holy. Never mind that God created it. It's nothing that inherently and intrinsically is worthy of celebration and honor and glory. It depends on what I do with it. Am I going to serve God with my body or not serve God with my body? If I do serve God with my body, then I sanctify it, and it becomes glorious, it becomes beautiful, it becomes noble, it becomes significant and important. But it depends on the choices I make. Okay. Well, that's not Platonism, because Platonism says this physical body is inherently evil, inherently disgusting, that all it can do is contaminate me. It can't be made glorious. It can't be made noble. Nothing you could do could make it noble. And I'm saying, no, that's not true. That's not the biblical perspective. The biblical perspective is it can be made beautiful, glorious, and noble if you employ your body in the right kind of way. So think sexuality here. If I behave sexually in a way that honors God's purposes, then sexuality becomes beautiful, glorious, noble, wonderful. If I don't, it's just an animal acting. And that, notice the number of times that the apostles talk about licentious, debauched behavior as beast-like. It's beast-like behavior. Why? I think there's a profound philosophical analysis behind that. Because all they are doing is satisfying the animal appetites of their physical bodies. They're not thinking morally. They're not allowing morality to trump their choices that would go in the direction of simply satisfying animal desires. So they're just acting like the beasts do. I mean, any beast can fulfill an appetite, right? But it takes a person created in the image of God to go the next step and ask a question, is that an appetite that I ought to satisfy right now? Is it living in obedience to God? Is it living in conformity with objective reality with respect to God's purposes and God's design and so on? That's what a moral person asks. A beast doesn't ask that.
I have a question, Jack. Mm-hmm. Could the same things you're saying about the body also be applied to our minds as we experience them now? Because there's such a mind-body connection. I mean, as you age, you lose faculty. As you grow, you do not make sense.
Okay, you mean brain.
Yeah, just like my thinking and...
Well, I would make a distinction between my brain and my mind. Mm-hmm. My brain decays, falls apart, slows down, I lose memory, I lose certain mental functions. But that's not me. Mm-hmm. That's just the mind that I have. It has a tool that's not as sharp as it used to be. Mm-hmm. And that limits how I can express myself in the world. But I don't think it's me deteriorating. I think it's the tool that my mind uses that's deteriorating.
Because, mm-hmm. I mean, our experience, do you think Paul is made by body? I guess the thought I had was, could Paul, by saying body, be talking about our experience in this life? The whole sum of our human experience, where, you know, I get sick and I feel inside that I personally suffer, but the reality is that the person who is me is maybe not as kind of transcending that experience in some way. But I still experience, like, suffering and, you know.
I'm not sure if I'm exactly grasping your question. I don't... The other difference between me and a Platonist would be there's a sense in which I am my body right now. It's the only interface between me and the rest of objective reality. So yes, my body is me. If something happens to my body, it's happening to me. I don't want to deny that. So it's not like, you know, there's this fortress body and then back in the dark recesses of this protected from the outside world is me. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting is the me that God has in mind to maintain my existence forever and ever and ever is not this body and doesn't even need this body to still be me.
I think that helps.
And so what I'm going to argue, I mean, no, remember what Jesus said, you know, that the Sadducees, I think it was, came up with this really smart alecky question to ask Jesus about brothers who engage in leveret marriage where seven brothers were married to the same woman. Okay, Jesus, I've got a puzzle for you. Which one of them is he married to in heaven? And Jesus' point is, you don't understand. When we go beyond this existence to the next existence, he says we're going to be like the angels. There will be neither marriage nor giving in marriage in the age to come. Now, It could be that what he's saying is we're going to be sexual beings just like we are now, but in the eternal kingdom of God, you won't be able to get married. Well, that sounds like hell, not heaven to me. But I don't think that's what he's saying. I think the part of you'll be like the angels is you are going to become no longer sexual beings like you are here and now in this world. You will no longer be biologically male and biologically female like we are now. We're going to be a different kind of being, a different kind of humanity. Now, later in my notes, I'm going to propose, I wouldn't be surprised, I think it makes a lot of sense, that we will still be male and female, because I think there's a whole lot more to male and female than physiology, anatomy, hormones, and stuff like that. So I think there are probably for all of eternity a male version of humanity and a female version of humanity. I may be wrong about that, but I think that's probably true. But it won't manifest itself physiologically in the same way that it does now. And animal sexuality will no longer be mapped onto human sexuality as it is now. We will no longer have sexuality in that sense. It'll be in a strictly ideal spiritual sense that we are male and female. Why did I go there? Was that related any at all?
Sorry, I think that what you said helped.
Okay. All right. So I think, rather than read through all these notes, point three there, sexual desire per se is not spiritual, transcendent, eternal, or even ennobling. It is not an ultimate good. Indeed, being connected with an inferior animal-like facet of who I am, it has the potential to be demeaning. It's not inherently demeaning, but it has the potential to be that. Now, why do I say that? The reason I say that is, I don't know if there's anybody out there today, but in the 1960s, there was a group of Christian street people called the Christian World Liberation Front. Christian World Liberation Front. Very colorful group. And I had a lot of contact with them and would go to their studies and teach some of their things every now and then. Out of that group came an individual who started another organization, and his whole project was to basically say, come to Jesus because in Jesus you'll learn how to be rightly attuned with God and your sexuality will become a part of your spirituality. And basically what he was arguing is sexuality is such a wonderful, beautiful experience. The euphoria of sexual pleasure is so wonderful, and so it's transcendent. That is to say, it's spiritual. So it somehow is connected with spirituality itself. So he was basically trying to turn spirituality into super sexuality. It's by pursuing sexuality to the highest degree that you are pursuing spirituality. And that it's to that I'm saying, nah, that's not what sex is. It's not that inherently glorious and ennobling and wonderful and beautiful and not eternal and not transcendent. It's physiology is what it is. And sex as we experience it is part of our animal nature. It's hormones that are working. And no matter how pleasurable it might be, and no matter how much that pleasure may be connected by God's design with a kind of vision for what a relationship, a marital relationship can be and should be, and I will argue that that's the case, it's still just an experience. It's still just a drug experience, an organic one, but a drug experience. And as such, it has nothing to do with spirituality. It doesn't transcend. Is there a question?
Yes, there's three questions from online, so I'll just give you one and you respond to that. Sam Weiss asks, would you also distinguish yourself from Plato in that the spiritual or heavenly body which we are promised will be a physical body as well, just glorified and free from sin?
Yes, yes. Yeah, physical. See, Paul's having to stretch his language in 1 Corinthians 15. You know, he calls it a heavenly body. He calls it a spiritual body, which almost sounds like a contradiction, right? A spiritual body. He's really stretching his language because I think Paul believes, you know, matter and stuff and physicality as we know it is going to be transcended. But the point is, we are going to have a concrete, tangible existence. It's just that we have no clue as to what that concrete, tangible existence will be like because we ain't there. We haven't experienced that yet. But yes, we are not disembodied, floating Casper the Friendly Ghost spirits that go to heaven. That's also out of Platonism. I don't agree with that.
Next question, Gil Greco asks, could you coin a term for what happens when I let my psychology direct my actions? If I'm animal, when I let my hormones take over, what happens when I allow something non-hormonal to direct my actions?
Well, I think the Bible would call it spiritual, in the sense that we are encouraged to walk according to the Spirit and not according to the flesh. And what he means by that is, the Spirit of God is my tutor. And if I listen to the instruction of my tutor, I am walking according to the instruction of the Spirit of God. I'm walking according to the Spirit. And that's what we should be doing, instead of listening to all the noises coming out of my body and its hormones and its desires and its passions and so on. I shouldn't be listening to that and heeding that. I should be heeding the instruction by God himself as to what is good, what is right, what is true.
Can I ask a question about that? It sounds like from what you've been saying before that what you mean is I shouldn't just be listening to my hormones and physical urges, because sometimes those line up with God.
Oh, absolutely.
Like,
yes, yes.
You know, have children and things like that.
Yeah, if you're hungry, sometimes it's okay to eat. Yeah, absolutely. They're pretty loud. Some of them are hard to ignore. So we will listen to them. And there's nothing wrong with listening to them. They shouldn't direct and dictate what we do, though. I should always ask, I'm always going, maybe not always, but normally, typically, we will know what we want. But that doesn't settle the question of what I should do. I want this, but there's another question to ask at that point. But is it consistent with what is good and right and true to do that? If not, I say no to my passions. If it is consistent, as best I can tell, then I'm at liberty to satisfy my passions, if it's consistent with what's good and right and true. Yeah, thank you.
And the last question is from Mike, and he's asking, Jack has referred to the modern mindset and the modern values a couple of times now with respect to very specific viewpoints. So what is your source for determining what constitutes modern position?
Just breathing the air of this culture. Television, movies, music, my neighbors, me. This is not a scientific, this is not a research position. This is my assessment as somebody who is intimately acquainted with the world that I live in, opening my mouth and saying, here's what I see in the world that I live in. That's all. I think I've basically commented on everything in point three there, unless you see something that you want me to comment on that I... Okay, point four then. Well, let's see. Subpoint five, the physical animalistic nature of my sexuality is in and of itself morally undiscerning and does not discriminate between various sexual behaviors. That is, there's not a class of sexual behaviors that is inappropriate to the animal in us. Hence, physical sexual response can be influenced, trained, or channeled to respond to anything. So it doesn't surprise me. The things in which human beings become sexually interested should come as no surprise to us at all. Just because a human being finds something sexually interesting does not make it natural and therefore moral, because sexual response is a trained response. It's not God-given and created and set in concrete from birth. It's something I trained myself in. So I mentioned last week the documentary by the BBC coming to America and interviewing people who have an erotic attachment to their automobiles. Well, I mean, on the one hand, is it natural in the sense that there are human males who do that? Yeah, it's natural in that sense. Is it natural in the sense that it's consistent with God's design and purpose for human sexuality? No, it's totally not in sync with God's design and God's purpose. In that sense, it's unnatural. But does it surprise me that the human male is capable of having an erotic attachment with his automobile? Well, I'm not that into automobiles, so I mean, in that sense, it's a surprise to me. But it's not a surprise to me in the sense that I'm a human male, and I am fully, keenly aware of how easy it would be for me to train myself to be sexually attracted to anything I set my mind to. I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Can you explain a little bit what you mean by trained, like how that works?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's probably a bad choice of words. I mean, we don't set out typically to train ourselves in a particular way. But the choices I've made, the experiences I've had, the things that I've encountered, the things I've been exposed to, they all give me an opportunity. All along the way, I'm making some choices about what I'm going to do with them, what I'm going to validate and what I'm not going to validate. And that's the critical piece. Because two people can have the same experiences and it will have a different impact on them. Because one person has decided to validate their experience and their response to that experience. Another person has distanced himself from his response and his experience and said, has trumped it with the question of morality. That is, okay, I feel what I feel. I respond the way I respond. I'm interested in what I'm interested in potentially. Should I be? Is that right? Is that consistent with God's design and God's purposes? Then however real my subjective response is, it's not consistent with the objective reality and the objective truth of what God wanted sexuality to be. Therefore, I repudiate it.
Okay, yeah. So let me try to paint a picture of how this works. So you have, I don't know what you want to call it, like an instinctual urge or something that you start out with.
I think we do have that.
Pre-trained, yeah. Or you're using the word trained. And then you either validate or you don't validate those. And depending on whether or not you validate it or not, that has something to say about your trained sexual desires or sexual preferences.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what happens? Are you seeing these urges as just like these random things that are thrown out here and there? And some of them you end up validating, some of them you don't. And then they just like end up fading away and new ones come? Or how does it work? How does that look?
I don't recognize what I believe in what you describe, but I wouldn't say any of it's random. We take a lot of cues from our culture. So the culture is going to tell you to, here's an acceptable sexual response, here's an unacceptable sexual response. Get excited about this, don't get excited about this. I think to a large extent, my culture shapes me and molds me in that respect. And the culture can steer me in the right direction in that regard. And it can steer me in the wrong direction in that regard. It can go either way. So I don't think there's anything random about that. I mean, that's input that's...
I guess what I'm wondering is, can you have this specific type of instinctual urge that consistently is coming in someone's life, and they are not validating it or trying not to validate it, but it doesn't go away? I mean,
sure.
You would account for that?
Okay. Oh, I would think so, yeah.
And that, you would say, is... That's not something. So when you say physical sexual response can be influenced, trained, or channeled, you're saying that's something different than what's going on here. Like that. So just because something, I guess, is consistently a part, like a consistent desire, let's say, doesn't mean necessarily it's something that someone has trained themselves or forged or.
Right. I think to the end of our days, we will be interested and intrigued and attracted to things that it's immoral to be interested, intrigued, and attracted to. And how ought we, I think, as followers of Jesus, to respond to them? To constantly judge our own response by the standards of goodness and morality. It doesn't make it go away, but I'm doing the right thing with it. I'm saying, okay, I'm intrigued by that, I'm interested in that, but that would be like wrong. See, even the garden, what she should have done, she should have been able to do, is instead of when the tempter comes along and makes her interested in this proposal, this is good to make you wise, instead of kind of innocently giving priority to what's right and good and saying, but that would be disobedient. I mean, that would be wrong. I mean, doesn't that kind of settle it? Instead of that, she validates the temptation. She validates the desire. She validates the impulse to be wise in this particular way. Well, validating it is evil. Saying no to it is good. There is nothing evil about being initially intrigued to start with. I think that just happens. in ways that I can't even pretend to analyze and explain. Why are we interested in the particular things we're interested in? I have no idea. Has to do with our experience, has to do with our probably some things genetic built in, probably has something to do with that, probably has something to do with all kinds of different things. No way I can analyze it. But from a biblical perspective, it doesn't really matter that I be able to give an account of the genesis of it. The question is, what do I do with it? How do I react to it and how do I respond to it? That's the issue. Did you have
a common objection to that? If I'm understanding your argument correctly, it's that everyone has sexual urges, some of which would be moral to act upon, some of which would not be moral to act upon, and by a pattern of choosing the good over the, you know, what nature would have us do, then we can train our sexuality.
No, I'm sorry. That I must have sounded like I was saying that. No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that we can train our urges. At least it works one direction and not the other one. I think we can train ourselves to like things that we ought not to like, but I'm not convinced that we can train ourselves to not like things that we ought not to like. Does that make sense?
Say that again.
Okay, let's take the most controversial thing in the culture today, homosexuality. Can someone who says, but I have homosexual attractions, I have homosexual urges, and I want to get rid of them, can you help me get rid of them? I suppose there are Christians out there, I'm almost confident that there are Christians out there who would say, well, come to Jesus and he'll take care of your urges, he'll get rid of your urges. Or come to Jesus and my seminar and we'll teach you how to get rid of your urges, or something along those lines. I would never make that kind of claim. I can't get rid of my urges. Why should I think anybody else can get rid of their urges? We are fundamentally depraved people. We are fundamentally evil people, every one of us. So having urges that are inconsistent with what's good and right and true just makes all the sense in the world from a biblical perspective. Of course we're going to have them. The question is, what do you do with them? So I'm not trying to suggest that we can train ourselves away from evil. I'm not suggesting that.
But would it be fair to say that you can at least train a character that chooses good over the evil?
Yeah. Although I hesitate there because many Christians like to compare growth in spirituality with physical conditioning, that through training, that is through practice, you become better at it. I don't think that's how spirituality works. It's not by exercising my choice toward good that I become more able to choose good. I don't think so. I think choosing good is just a raw fact in and of itself. I either do it or I don't do it. And I can't get better at it. I just need to continue to validate the good every opportunity I get whenever I come to that crossroads.
I think the point that you made about not being able to get rid of my urges is really important in that debate about, is homosexuality, what exactly is wrong about that, if anything? Because I've heard a lot of people in the Christian community who say, you know, there's nothing wrong with homosexuality per se, say it's being gay is who I am. I can't get rid of that aspect of myself. I could like not ever act on it, but I would always have those urges, and that's just a fundamental part of myself. And that's what I mean when I say I'm gay, not that I do homosexual behaviors. And I found that interesting because it seems like, well, I can't know for sure whether or not you're choosing to dwell on those urges, and like, or if it's good for you to make that part of your identity. I mean, regardless of that or not, there seems to be something very real going on there that, at least in my Christian upbringing, was kind of rejected as, no, you want to have those urges, you want to, and maybe some people do, but I thought it was interesting that a lot of Christians are trying to make that distinction of, it's who I am, it's not what I'm doing. And I'd be interested to hear what you think about that.
Okay, I actually am going to address that later in the notes. Yeah.
But I do find it interesting that you're saying, you know, it's not the urges that we are trying to be rid of, or that we even could be, because that was definitely something that a lot of people, I mean, growing up thought could happen or should happen for you to be a believer.
Yeah, I just think that that's comes out of a very naive theology that has a very unrealistic view of sin and evil and human depravity. It just doesn't get it. And I think over the years of teaching the Bible, I've come to realize that the Bible has a very, very robust account of how depraved and perverse and evil every one of us as human beings is. That's the bottom line. In this whole debate about homosexuality, why is it that someone like me wants to be insistent that we call homosexuality wrong? Same reason I'm insistent that we call greed wrong, that we call cruelty wrong, that we call murder wrong, that we call anything wrong that's wrong, because every one of them is a symptom of this deep-seated problem that human beings have that's going to kill us if we don't acknowledge it, face into it, and accept the mercy of God. If I can just pass off the various manifestations of my perversity as, well, that's just me, I don't need no mercy then. And the one who doesn't need mercy is the one who doesn't get mercy. Do I want to leave people there? That you don't get mercy? No, I don't want to leave people there. Of course I want them to get mercy. That's the gospel. That's the gospel that we proclaim if we are evangelists, if we are believers in the gospel of Jesus Christ, is there's mercy for us who don't deserve to live. But there's so many ways to manifest and display the fact that we don't deserve to live. Homosexuality is one of them. It's not the only one. There are dozens of them, and every one of them condemns us.
And like you're saying, there are so many ways to not get that we don't deserve.
Exactly.
And that's just one of them.
Exactly.
I think that helps a lot because it's not primarily a cultural issue for you, a societal problem that you're trying to eradicate or address. It's a personal, individual. Mm-hmm. Every single person has to think through this and really wrestle with this for themselves, no matter what that thing or thing, all those things are that are, yeah, are the things that we condemn us, I guess.
The fate of the homosexual is the same as the fate of the self-righteous, hypocritical Pharisee. And I would like to stamp out Phariseeism just as surely as I would like to stamp out homosexuality. Mm-hmm. Stamp it out in the sense of put it in a category that we can all agree on, that this is a problem for us human beings. God, have mercy on us.
And I'm sure you'd be the first person, want yourself to be the first person to say, I'm the first person in whom that any all of these things should be stamped out.
Yeah, if I can't say that, I don't believe the Bible. Absolutely.
I'm pushing you towards some of these things to say them because I've seen some online comments about what you're saying that I think really misunderstand where you're coming from on all this. It's unfortunate, but I'm from the years that I've spent here hearing you speak about things, I feel like I get that about you, that you're saying, look, if I hate homosexuals, then I hate myself, you know? If I hate sin is where you've been coming from. And there are people there who have totally missed that.
Yeah, I probably don't even hate sin as much as I ought to hate sin. We can't hate sin enough, but I'm trying to be true to the biblical message. And the biblical message is to reach out with a message of mercy and hope for people like me who don't deserve to live. And none of us do ourselves a favor by saying, nothing wrong with me. Don't call me wrong. Don't say I'm perverse. Don't say I'm evil. That's the deadly thing, is to look at what is depraved and perverse and call it good. That blocks the mercy of God more than anything else. I don't want people doing that.
So to clarify, you're not, the end goal of this would not be to gain control over everyone's actions or everyone's thought to make them basically come on your side and for society to act a certain way. The end goal that you're looking for is for people to kind of be honest about the evil that is in themselves. Is that kind of what you're acting like it's nothing?
Yeah, I mean, it never, when I thought to make this course, it never occurred to me to think of it in social political terms. This is about, what do I do? It's not what society does, it's what do I do? That's what I'm concerned about. Now, if we want to ask about society and politics, which was really not in my thinking, it is the case that the laws, the values, the kind of the public structures that we create in the civilization create a people, create the character of a people. I read a very important book this past year by a guy named Angelo Codevilla called The Character of Nations. And he just goes through history looking at how the laws of a nation affected the character of the people in that nation. And I mean, unfortunately, it just seems to be an empirical fact that when we all get together and create a certain set of laws, there's a feedback effect that actually creates the character of the people by those laws. So people are not wrong to be alarmed about the direction that the politics of our society might be going. But if I live in Sodom and Gomorrah, I live in Sodom and Gomorrah. I don't have any reason to change Sodom and Gomorrah into something else. I still have to worry about me in the midst of Sodom and Gomorrah. You live the way you live, you do what you do, you be what you be, but I need to preserve my own soul by making sure that my focus is on what's good, what's right, what's true, what's objectively real, and live my life in the light of that. And that's what's critical. So I had us as individuals in mind when I put these notes together. I didn't have in mind any social political agenda.
Yeah, I mean, did you mention the underculture and the counterculture thing, which that's kind of something like what I was really getting at. But then, like, you also had a mention of homosexual marriage, which kind of, like, anytime I see that, I'm kind of just like, oh, wait a minute. Because it's like, makes, when people bring that up, it almost feels like you're going into the category of, like, a war over trying to control, like, culture and the actions of people, rather than just trying to call people as individuals to deal with things. But when you brought it up, you weren't like, all you were using it for an example.
Yeah, these are just examples of depravity. It's not, it's stuff for us to, as individuals, to confront. What do I think about it? How am I supposed to frame this? How am I supposed to assess this? It's moral judgments that I'm making. And I ultimately make moral judgments for my own sake. If I stand up and protest, it's not because I expect to change the world. It's because I need to guard my own soul. I need to make sure that I am lined up with what's true.
We have a couple of questions from the web, if now's a good time.
Sure.
Gil asks, are you saying that one cannot engage in dissipation in a non-biological way?
No, I think you can. I'm not sure where that question is coming from. What is it?
It's from earlier.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure of the context of that anymore. It was about 15 minutes ago.
Okay. No, I think dissipation is just basically wasting your life. And I think you can waste your life in intellectual pursuits, and in, I think religious people are often engaging in dissipation.
And the other question is, again, fairly old now, but by trained you mean conditioned, right? That is, we become conditioned to release natural drugs which are released in the physical aspect of sex.
Yeah, I think that's possible, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have several questions, but it's just interesting how, as the sexual culture has, increased, well, as the proclivity to be more sexual has increased, it's interesting how there are all these 12-step programs, and one is for sex addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting how they do try to change a person's urges. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that. And also speaking to how churches, either through making celibate or fundamentalism, Islamic or Jewish or whatever, has like tried to quell urges. So if you could speak to the sexual addiction stuff, and then how they try to fix things in that manner, and then also the...
Well, that's part of the modern culture, and the part of the modern mindset is behaviorism. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't surprise me that probably a very common method would be a behavioristic model. What's happening is you've made the wiring bad in the brain, so we need to rewire it. We're not dealing with a person any longer. We're dealing with a brain and an animal and an organism, and that's all we're dealing with. So let's figure out techniques and ways to map the synapses differently than they are right now, and that'll get rid of the urge and get rid of the behavior, and we'll be all good. I don't accept behaviorism. I think behaviorism is completely incompatible with the biblical worldview, because I think the biblical worldview insists that however much my body may be an organism, an organic robot, however much that might be true, it is connected with a person. And as a person, I have a mind and a will that is not simply determined by biological strings pulling on it.
But it is interesting that they see it as a problem.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That it's not just anything goes.
Right.
So there is a boundary they put there. I don't know why, but mm-hmm. And anyway, about priests and, ecstasy and...
Yeah, one way religious people have always dealt with sin is by being terrified of it, but not admitting it. I mean, the last thing we will do is acknowledge that it's there and that it's real and that it's a fact of my existence. So instead, we try to suppress it. Let's just stuff it down and pretend like it's not there. And I will do all these religious things, and I will do all these pious things, and I will be a wonderful person, and I will perform for you so that you can see how righteous I am. And sooner or later, if I perform well enough, can we just call it good and say that doesn't exist down there, that ugly, obscene depravity down there? Whereas the biblical perspective is to be transparent about our sinfulness. I don't need to suppress it. I don't need to hide it from anybody. I should be the first person to admit to anyone and everyone that I am a depraved sinner. And then by doing that, I have no reason, no cause any longer to follow some script or to hide it or cover it up or whatever. But I think a lot of religious traditions, in one way or another, find a way to do that.
So as you said, the Pharisee and the...
Yeah.
And whatever this was earlier.
Yeah, remember how Jesus described them? Yeah. You're whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones, shiny and white and newly painted, freshly painted on the outside, but you're as ugly as can be on the inside.
Actually, makes me think of the Scarlet Letter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so do we finish C? I've already commented on this, but I want to highlight this because this gets really confusing when we start about talking about ethics here. There's a problem with the concept of natural. Herein lies the problem with employing a concept of natural that would be defined as that which actually occurs among human beings. If we define natural as what human beings actually do and experience, then all sexual aberrations are natural. But that is not what the Bible would mean by natural. So in Romans 1, when he talks about this being against nature, what he means by that is he's saying that sexual perversions are against nature in the sense that they are contrary to God's design, God's purpose with respect to human sexuality. So we have to be very careful how we define our terms and what we mean by, especially by the word natural, when we're in discussion with dialogue about sexual ethics with people. Okay, point D then, the next place where Christian sexual ethics, biblical sexual ethics, and modern mindset is different. Sexual desires are learned and ultimately chosen. They are not the necessary mechanical result of the biological machine that I am. Hence, sexual behaviors are freely chosen acts for which I am morally accountable. They are not the necessary biologically caused actions of an organic robot. I started talking about desires. I think I meant behaviors, although I would still say the same thing about desires, but I think that point was supposed to be about behaviors. The modern myth is that homosexuality is an act of creation, just as like left-handedness or having black skin or having blonde hair. It's just a fact of the creation of me by God. In any case, it's not a choice, but it's something that comes about somehow, who knows, who cares, but it comes about somehow apart from free human choice. I had no control over it. I had no say in it. I just am a homosexual. Now, that's a very complicated issue, but the myth is just that, is that my homosexuality was given to me, so back off, buddy. Leave me alone. That's just the way I am. That's why in the modern debate, socially, there's a constant analogy between homosexuality and race. Because just as the black did not choose the color of his skin, neither did the homosexual choose his sexual orientation. But if what the Bible teaches is true, then that must necessarily be a myth. Because the Bible would never call the color of your skin a perversion. But it does call homosexual behavior a perversion.
Hmm? So this is a question that I have here. For real. So if somebody is, they think of themselves as gay, and what they mean by that is that they're attracted to people of the same sex. Is that attraction in and of itself something that is learned and not something that, not necessarily that they were born with, but for whatever outside conditioning or any kind of reason, something that they've inherited and is now something that they will always live with?
Well, I don't ultimately know, but I suspect that it is chosen, but it's chosen at such a subtle level that you would never know. I remember growing up as a kid, there was a little 3-year-old girl who was our neighbor, who as a 3-year-old was a pathological liar. I mean, pathological liar. It was incredible. Was she born that way, or did she choose it? I mean, it's manifesting itself incredibly early in her life and her experience. Which is it? Is there any question that it's evil? Not in my mind. I mean, wherever it came from, whatever the genesis of it, whatever pieces go into making her a pathological liar at 3 years old, it's evil to be a liar. I would have to assume and I would have to expect that somewhere in there she made some choices. She had an opportunity to give herself over to this strategy in her human relationships, or to say no to that strategy in her human relationships, and somewhere along the line she gave herself over to it. I doubt if she remembers it. I doubt if she looked back, she could say, well, I remember the day that I chose to be a liar. I mean, of course not. But it's almost unimaginable to me that that wasn't at least an element of the genesis of that problem. Now, are her habits toward pathological lying in and of themselves, or is her inclination perverse? I think so. I think it's a function of human depravity. The fact that she might be plagued her whole life with always being tempted to do that, is it evil of her that she's tempted? No. That's what she came to be. That's the war that she's going to have to fight. That's part of the journey that she's on, is to do battle with that tendency now, whatever its genesis. But as if she were a follower of Jesus today and being sanctified, she probably still battles tendency to tell a lie. That's the natural thing for her. That's what first comes to mind. But I could imagine her just constantly checking that with, but that would be wrong. Or having done it, that was wrong. And that's what we're called to. We're not, I have it here somewhere in my notes. We're not called to purity. I mean, good grief. Who of us can be pure? We're not called to purity, sexual purity or otherwise, we're not called to it in the sense that there's no expectation in the Bible that you're going to be able to transcend your depravity in the area of your sexuality and be free of everything depraved. Well, of course not. But are we going to be authentic followers of Jesus? That's the issue. In the midst of that depravity, am I going to take seriously his instruction, what he's calling me to, what he's inviting me to, and take that on and strive as best a sinner can do, as best a depraved sinner can do, strive to conform my actions and beliefs and attitudes to what Jesus instructs me?
So if I could sum up what you're saying for myself to make sure that I understand what you're saying. These inclinations, let's just say, to homosexual behavior, to want that, to be attracted to that, that may or may not be something that is chosen, but there is probably an element of choice in there somewhere, whether or not we experience it or remember experiencing it that way. But that is important to get straight, that desire, that inclination is an inclination towards something that is wrong.
Exactly.
That's something that is not part of God's purposes. But just because I may live my entire life with that inclination being the thing I want most, the realization of that inclination being the thing that I want most in the world, that struggling against that, just because I would struggle against that, does not mean that I am like out doing something wrong.
In fact,
God would
absolutely not. I mean, I can't imagine that at some level, in some way, that's not the experience of every believer. With something, yeah. Some way in which my past, my experience, my history, and so on, has set me up to be weak and vulnerable morally with respect to, you know, there's something that I should have a different attitude toward, or a different perspective on, a different value system with respect to that, that comes hard for me because of choices I've made, things I've done, things I've set myself up for. It doesn't mean I'm not a believer. It just means that I've got a fight on my hands. And the question is, are you going to join the fight or are you going to surrender? I mean, that's always the question. Do you do battle with yourself or not? That's the difference between the biblical worldview and the modern worldview. The modern worldview is, I need to be true to myself, right? I need to be authentic. So what I want, what my passions are, and so on, I need to take the liberty to express them and give expression to my desires, because that's what defines me. The biblical perspective is, let's get one thing straight from the get-go. Who I am is bad. I don't want that expressed. I don't want to give expression to who I really am. I don't want to give license to who I really am. I don't want to give freedom to who I really am. My whole purpose in life is to run away from who I really am, to strive to be what God is calling me to be, rather than to honestly express the depravity that is me. A fundamentally different worldview.
And I think I just realized something about what you were saying before about the body and the person that I am. You're not saying the body is what makes me bad. The person.
It's the person. It's the person that's stinking bad.
And
yeah.
In fact, like, it's almost a, like, some of the diss to the animals to call our, like, regression animal, because they're acting probably more in accordance with that.
Good point. That's a good point.
We only act on that. It is a denigration of what God made us to be.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it seems like the Bible is full of examples of that. David, Solomon, I mean,
yeah,
that's
sure.
What it's all about.
Absolutely.
But I was going to say, I just recently, I don't know how long ago, but there was an article in the paper that talked about how there's like science now behind, and I don't remember all the science part, but something, I don't know if it's the DNA or if it's how the genitalia is developed in utero, but there's some evidence that some people have, or like maybe it's more X chromosome, what, I don't even know. But there's some evidence now, like concrete evidence, that they're saying that they can see why people have these certain inclinations.
Okay.
Have you heard that?
No, but...
Has anyone heard that? Am I making it up? No, okay. Okay, you've heard that. But because I know your point still holds the same, but I think that gives people more credence to believe what they believe, you know, when they're already believing that it's okay.
Well, the thing is, if something has a biological origin where certain feelings are there just by biology, which was given me at birth and so on, then there is an analogy between race and an urge. And it would be cruel and irrational to blame them for something that's just biologically built into them. That's fine. That's great. We shouldn't blame them for that.
Blame them for the behavior or the urge?
For the urge. Okay. Yeah. But the question is, see, this, from a biblical perspective, this is so much bigger than me. That's the other. I don't have a point on my notes, but I should have if I had thought about it. The difference between a biblical ethic of any kind, sexual ethic included, and again, the modern mindset is, it's a question of me. It's a question of me fulfilling me satisfying me being me, etc., etc. As a disciple of Jesus, the question I'm asking is, what does God want me to do in the larger reality of His creation, of His story, of His purposes, of His plans? Am I going to honor them, or am I going to completely ignore them and make this all about me? So let's say we do know that there are people who are born by some kind of biological anomaly where they have mixed sex organs, for example. Well, obviously that's biological. I mean, that's clearly biological, right? They can't be blamed for that. But the question doesn't just become, I got a raw deal here and I don't even know where to go with that. But if that were true of me as a disciple of Jesus, the perspective I'd want to have is, I am not biologically normal. So what does that mean for how I live my life in obedience to the purposes of God? How do I honor Him? How do I serve Him? And so on. And it may mean celibacy or any number of things. I don't know. I mean, I haven't done the research. I'd have to figure it out. But I'm not asking the question, well, what about me? I'm asking the question, what are God's purposes and how do I fit in with that? That's the fundamental difference between the biblical perspective and the modern perspective.
I understand that, but I'm just saying that it gives that camp like more ammunition or like more reason. You know what I'm saying?
I'm sorry, it gives who more?
I said it gives the camp that's saying that maybe I was born that way.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
To,
right.
To say, see,
yeah.
See what we've been talking about.
Yeah, but I mean that's what the world is going to do, but we need to be clearer thinkers than that.
Right.
I mean the world is not going to be a clearer.
That it's interesting that yeah. has become an issue.
Yeah.
Well, because normal sexual urges have a biological element and
sure.
and we still have to
exactly.
ask that question with that. It's yeah. like we can just say it's not like heterosexuality is the like if you're oh if you get married and like then everything about your sexual behavior is good.
Mm-hmm.
That's not
yeah, it would a Christian male, by virtue of the fact that they are a Christian, suddenly lose all their urges to be sexually intimate with a female who is not their wife? Don't think that's the universal experience of Christian males. They have to ask the question with respect to that desire, do I want to validate that desire or do I want to say no to that desire? Because it would be wrong. It would be immoral. So it would be totally inappropriate for me to validate the desire. The desire itself validated would be wrong, even if I didn't act on it. It's the very fact that I would validate the desire is already perverse. That's what Jesus had said when, if you look after a woman and lust after her in your heart, it's you're just as culpable as if you had committed the act of adultery.
I know it pretty much kind of yeah. I feel like there's a lot of terms that aren't well enough defined for me that are used here. And there's several others, but like just validate, like, are you talking about validate? Are you talking about saying, yes, that is something I'm interested in?
Yeah.
Because it seems like if it's an urge, of course it's something you're interested in.
Well, but you have to make, granted it's a subtle distinction, but it's an important distinction. I mean, an urge is an urge, mm-hmm. so I find it compelling in the sense that it's an urge. But can I also desire to do good? Mm-hmm. So if at the same time I desire to do good and I give ascendancy, I give preference for my desire to do good over what I urge, then I have not validated it. I've said this is more important than that.
So let's call it maybe a hunger, because I feel like that maybe captures a little bit more well, because there's an idea of something lasting that you can't just flip off with a hunger. So if you call it a hunger to be like, okay, this is something that I want that I'm not able to just basically discard this want. It's something that is sticking with me here and I can't get rid of it. To acknowledge that would not be to validate it. You're saying to validate it would be like, okay, it's here, so you know what? I'm just going to pursue that. Is that kind of what validating it is?
Well, yes. That would be to validate it or falling short of that. That is, I'm going to pursue it. I may not pursue it. There may be other reasons why I'm not going to act on it, but I sure like the idea of pursuing it. And morality be damned. Morality is irrelevant.
Oh, morality irrelevant. Okay. I'm calling it hunger. So let's say hunger. I mean, you like the idea of pursuing a hunger because it's going to fulfill you. But what if you have this idea of, I really, really want that, and I like the idea of pursuing it, but I like morality also, and I think it's wrong, so I'm just going to suffer through it. Like, that wouldn't be validating it, would it? I mean, I'm...
Right. No, I don't think so. But let's take the analogy of physical hunger, because I think that might be helpful. You know, I have the feelings of hunger and the desires that go with that. I could eat. That would be to satisfy it. But what if I decide the only way I can eat is by taking food out of the mouths of somebody else? I can't do that. There's a place in between that I could stand. I don't act. I don't eat. But I sit there and obsess over food. I think that's a way of validating the desire.
And to rewind, you had mentioned the lusting after the woman, and you are culpable for that. I think it's the same idea.
Exactly.
Because when you, like you say, find it interesting, you're saying, is that I'm not going to do this because I don't like the consequences, or it's not a good time, or it would get me in trouble with other people or something. So I'm not going to pursue that adulterous relationship, for example. But would that I could.
Yeah,
because that
exactly.
would be...
That would be to validate. That's to validate it. Exactly. Would that I could. Would that I could do it in anonymity and not get caught, that I could not pay the consequences, etc., etc. I don't trumpet with, but it's not good. I trumpet with, it's not exactly convenient or logistically possible or whatever. That doesn't count. That's not morality. I gotta let you go. Sorry.